This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We try to get around here at T-Book Central. A few weeks ago, we loaded up the truck and attended a two-day seminar on character education. The event took place in New Orleans. So, of course, one of the people I met and talked to is doing their work in New York City.
As a family of 21 schools that work in conjunction with the New York City Department of Education to meet our mission of providing social and economic development and mobility for our students.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll introduce you to the Urban Assembly. Then we'll talk to a teacher and medical professional who suffered an on-the-job injury and hear how she's been living with pain, but without pills. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute looking at both sides of human character. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The New York City public school system is the largest in the United States, with over 1,200 schools and more than 1.1 million students enrolled each year. For more than a decade, it's also been the site of an unprecedented investment in high school reform. Beginning in 2002, the City Department of Education closed many large, comprehensive high schools with a history of low performance and created hundreds of new, smaller secondary schools. The small school movement has been a national one, with nearly every major American urban district either creating new small schools or transforming large schools into campuses of small learning communities. In 1997, the Urban Assembly started its first school in the Bronx. They now run about two dozen schools around the city. David Adams is the director of social and emotional learning at the Urban Assembly. He took some time to speak with me about his group.
So the Urban Assembly is a family of 21 schools that work in conjunction with the New York City Department of Education to meet our mission of providing social and economic development and mobility for our students. We serve about 9,000 students across 21 schools located in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Bronx, and one school on the border of Queens and Brooklyn. Our students bring a lot of strengths to the table. I would say they're some of the top students in the city. We have some of the top schools in the city in terms of graduation rates. And we look to support our students and support their strengths by supporting their social-emotional development, make sure they have academically rigorous coursework, and make sure they have access to post-secondary college and career options.
Are you funded completely by the city school district, or do you have outside funders?
We have about one-fourth of our budget comes from the district, and then the three-fourths of the budget comes from private donations.
And how do you choose the schools or the students?
So we started the schools. We are part of the small schools movement, so when the comprehensive high schools broke down, we were able to start many schools in New York City Department of Education in order to support that small school 400 to 500 kind of students environment for our students. And our focus is making sure that students who have high needs can get high-quality education so they can have economic mobility.
In these schools, how important is character education?
So we focus a lot on the social and emotional development of our students as one of the foundational aspects of what it means to be a successful student in our schools. And there's a number of reasons for that. We want our students to be successful not only in school, but in life. That means that they need to understand how to resolve conflict. It means they have to communicate effectively. And this helps them not only, you know, with their brothers and their sisters and their moms, but also when you get into a job and you have a boss who has a issue with you. I just had a conversation with a student the other day. She was on an internship. She wasn't getting paid. She went up to her boss and she said, "I remember the importance of making a good impression and being able to resolve conflicts effectively." And she said, "You know, I maintained my relationship with my boss, but I still got paid." So it's a foundational aspect of what we do in our schools because we believe economic and social mobility are the result of high-quality education, which means not just I can think and read and write, but also I can relate to myself and relate to others in effective ways.
How much are you fighting a student's background? I'm sure you talked about problem resolution there. What if a child comes from a home where their father said, "You got a problem, hit him in the face"?
It's a funny story. We had a question one time with our students, and they said, "Well, you know, why should schools teach us versus parents?" I think when we think about what people want, people want respect. People want to be able to interact effectively. And so different groups or different backgrounds may interpret how you get that in different ways. Respect may come through aggression or physical aggression in different backgrounds. So What we're trying to do is give our students another way to be successful. I think when we work with our communities, when we work with our families, when we work with our students, they come together and say, you know, this is a better way of being. And I think that's where our students are at, and that's what they want.
So how does a character education affect a student's total education?
So
is it going to make them better at math?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I think one of the more robust findings, the Aspen Commission had their Council of Distinguished Scientists publish a recent report, talks about consensus of evidence. And one of the most robust kind of pieces of evidence with regards to social emotional academic development is that it has a positive impact on academic achievement. In our own schools, we've measured this. We've identified some of the pathways through personal responsibility, through optimistic thinking, that developing social-emotional learning improves academic achievement. We know that the quality of relationships between teachers and students, the quality of culture in the classroom also has an impact in terms of improving academic achievement. So I think the good news is if you're a school and you're thinking about doing this and you're trying to compete with other priorities in terms of your academics, you should know that focusing on social-emotional academic development will help your students be more successful academically, more importantly, in life and in what they do after they leave you. The National Commission for Social, Emotional, and Academic Development is an Aspen Institute-sponsored program that's looking to galvanize the K-12 education system across the country to focus on social-emotional academic development as a part and parcel of what it means to be educated in this country. So they have brought together teachers, scientists, funders, practitioners, community-based organizations from across the country to come up with a consensus that to be educated and what does it mean to educate our students is to combine social-emotional and academic development so that our students can be successful not only socially but economically, as well as have an opportunity to contribute to society.
And this is something that Urban Assembly is a part of or came from?
Yeah, so the Aspen Commission is separate from the Urban Assembly. I'm a member of it. It's essentially just a gathering of people from across the country who have focused a lot on social-emotional academic development.
So how do you measure success?
We measure success in five different ways with regards to the work we do. We look at attendance as an indicator of students' relationships within their school. We look at school climate culture, and we use the school survey through the New York City Department of Education. And within that survey, we look at the quality of trust in the schools, and we look at the quality of supportive learning environments in the schools. We look at academic achievement. We specifically look at ninth grade credit accumulation as an indicator of a student being on track for graduation, as an outcome that should improve and that will and has improved by implementing high-quality social-emotional learning. We look at social-emotional skills and competencies themselves. We use the SEL EVO platform from Aperture Education to measure social-emotional skills. And then we look at discipline. We look to see a reduction in discipline as at the same time we're looking at an increase in school culture and climate. So we look at suspension rates as an indicator of the quality of interactions in the schools.
You talked about discipline. How is discipline handled in these schools? Is it traditional or you try something out of the box?
I think one of our students said the other day in one of our schools that they have a really strong code of conduct. And I think what she interpreted as a code of conduct is what we call a social contract. The social contract is when students come together and make an agreement around how they're going to interact with each other in the schools. And I think when you're in high schools, you think that students are going to would have difficulty kind of coming up with pro-social kind of concepts, but they don't. You know, students want to be treated with respect. They want to communicate effectively. They want to resolve conflict effectively. So when we discipline our kids in our schools, we discipline them with the eye of what does it take to be part of our community? How do we maintain that community? And what do we do with situations that take away from our community? We focus a lot on making sure that any student who is removed from our communities are developed in terms of coming back. So, like, what is it that you are challenged with? If it's resolving conflict, then we're not going to just take you, throw you out of our school and say, good luck resolving conflict. We're going to bring you back and say, hey, let's sit down and resolve that conflict. Let's teach you the kinds of things that you need to do so you don't have the situation happen in the future. So I would say we have a discipline system that emphasizes community and teaching. If our students have challenges, it's because they either don't understand something or don't want to do it. And so we need to teach them what they need to do and then create an environment in which doing that gets their needs met in the most efficient way.
And how has your success been? How, like, graduation rates been with schools you've either replaced or are working around?
Yeah, so I think this is t- off the top of my head. We've had great success. We did an evaluation for three of our schools who participated in a pilot focused on social emotional learning. Currently, our graduation rates in the Urban Assembly are at 80%, which is, I want to say, 7 points higher than the city, but I'm going to check that.
I'll check it before this airs.
7 points higher than the city in general. Our schools who have focused on social-emotional learning have seen an increase in credit accumulation in terms of their ninth grade, so they see more students who are on track for graduation. It takes a little bit of time to actually see the graduation rates because we started this work about 3 years ago. Our schools who focus on social-emotional learning have seen a reduction in suspensions. Compared to schools who haven't focused on it, we saw about a 44% reduction in suspensions versus a 19% reduction in suspensions or schools who weren't focused on social emotional learning development or focused in a different way. Our schools had increased trust as measured through the Learning Environment Survey in New York City, and they had experienced a stronger supportive learning environment, which is things like classroom behavior, academic press, and the way that students are largely relating to each other. The one thing that we still struggle with, it was looking at attendance as an outcome of increased social emotional development. So we haven't seen upticks in attendance the way that we've seen upticks in these other qualities. And lastly, we've seen students with better social-emotional skills. So like we were talking about in here, it's not like a one-indicator game, right? Like you don't just reduce suspensions and say you're doing a good job. You triangulate the data. You say, all right, we've seen students increase their social-emotional skills. Looks like supportive learning environment and trust have increased. Students feel more comfortable. And discipline incidents have gone down, right? So that gives you a picture that students are interacting in a way that's more appropriate and more effective. And when you talk to principals about this work, what they say is that things are not escalating in the way that they escalated before. Teachers are more willing to listen to students' perspectives and not escalating the situation. Students are less likely to escalate the situations between two students. And everybody cares about the community and what they need to do to be part of that community.
Are you looking to expand in either inside or outside the city?
Yeah, so we're working with the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools in Los Angeles. They're a partnership similar situated to the Urban Assembly insofar as that they work with public schools, but they are a third-party nonprofit who manages and supports those schools. We had a grant from the Carnegie Foundation to help us expand to five schools in Los Angeles. So we're going to do that. We're doing that work as we speak in order to kind of scale some of the learnings that we have from New York City to some of the context in Los Angeles.
David Adams is the director of social and emotional learning at the Urban Assembly. Now, a quick note about New York City high school graduation rates. We looked it up. Those rates hit a record high in 2017. In all, 74.3% of New York City kids who entered high school in 2013 graduated in 4 years. That's a gain of 1.2 percentage points from the prior year. Dropout rates also hit an historic low last year, dipping to 7.8% citywide. As for the Urban Assembly, their graduation rate is sitting steady at 80.2%. Still to come, she's a teacher and an athlete, and she's trying to reclaim her life from pain. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Victoria Stopp has been active all her life. That became difficult about 10 years ago when she suffered an on-the-job injury which left her living with chronic nonstop pain. She's since gone from doctor to doctor looking for anything to relieve the pain and continue living a fit, athletic life. She writes about the experience in the new book, Hurting Like Hell, Living with Gusto. I spoke with Victoria Stopp recently and asked why she started writing about her pain.
I really originally did it because I was having trouble dealing with pain issues and being an athlete and being frustrated, and I really wanted to stay married. And so I thought that maybe an outlet for not complaining so much at home was to start a blog. And I did. After I started the blog and it took off for a couple of years, I was featured in Runner's World. And that really gave me the idea that there was a bigger audience than just a blog audience. And that is how the book started.
You talked about being an athlete. How much of an athlete were you?
I played soccer my whole life. I played soccer and softball in college. And then after college, I kept playing soccer in Atlanta on a women's league. And then I became a pretty big runner and started playing tennis again and different things. I just, any activity, hiking, whatever.
And given your bouts with pain, you still do a lot of that, though.
Yes, I do. I have to alter everything. So when I go camping, for instance, I have to take different props so that I can sleep at night. And that's a bit of a gamble because I have to make sure that I don't carry too much on my back in weight. But I also need all the things to situate myself for a nighttime. I don't race anymore in running. I just run by myself so that I'm not stuck on someone else's timeline in case I don't feel well one morning. But yes, I do keep doing pretty much whatever I can.
Well, let's talk about where this started. What was your injury like? What happened there?
Originally, I was hurt working as an emergency medical technician in the back of an ambulance, and I was standing over a patient, which you are not supposed to do, and I take responsibility for that. And I was thrown a bit in the back of the ambulance, and I was holding on to the stretcher and in a very awkward position. And at the time, being in my 20s and being very healthy and athletic, I thought it was something like a whiplash injury that would just go away. I planned to play soccer the next day. I had no idea that it would start a cascade of things and that a decade later I would be here like this.
And most of the doctors, if not all of the doctors you went to, just started writing prescriptions.
Oh, yeah. That was the very first thing. You know, it was like, take this pill, take that pill, and you'll be good to go. And it was kind of like a turn me loose sort of thing with a million pills. And they didn't work.
Can you see how somebody in your situation might just take that route and that's it? It's pills for life?
Absolutely. I have fought this for about a decade now. And especially when you are in severe pain, it's very hard to say no to those pills because even if they don't really work, you can take enough to knock yourself out. And at least you're not suffering if you're knocked out. I think that one thing that we really are not talking about in our national conversation about pill addiction is why a lot of people get addicted. And for me, at least, that answer is uncontrolled pain and different things that are not funded by most insurances, like acupuncture and massage, that actually help people. I'm a big believer in chiropractic, you know, so I guess what we consider alternative medicine often is out of pocket, but the pills are not out of pocket. And so what happens is people get to where they feel like they have no option but pills, whether it's financially or otherwise. And I think that we need to do a better job of talking about what leads people to that addiction, not just what to do about it once they have it.
Yes, you've expressed a lot of frustration with your care being managed by pencil pushers in an office someplace instead of doctors.
Absolutely. And these days, our insurance policy changes every year. And every year, it's, you know, a 2-day commitment to read the fine print and see what's covered and what's not. And more often than not, anything I need or want is not covered, or it is so minimally covered that it's essentially not covered.
How did you get beyond that? How did you get beyond the pills and try to just almost craft your own recovery?
Well, right now, I recently qualified for medical marijuana, and that has helped tremendously. I have not, if there's some wood, I'm going to knock on it. I have not had to take even an ibuprofen since using medical marijuana at night. But before that, I think it was pure bullheadedness that I knew when I was on different medications I didn't feel well, and I really often didn't feel better or they would work temporarily. And just being young and otherwise healthy and refusing to give into the temptation, I guess. But yeah, there have been years of misery. I mean, it hasn't been a simple, oh, well, I'm not going to take that and I'll be fine. It's been hot tubs, massages, chiropractic pretty constantly.
One of the things you hit on in the book, and it's something that I've talked about with a lot of people in the field, is the threat of injury for people in the medical field. It's a lot bigger than you'd think, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I've worked in multiple jobs in the medical industry, and I've also taught in a health sciences program locally at the college. And I really like to stress to my students good body mechanics and being careful and taking care of themselves, because there are so many unpredictable factors when you're working with ill people. And so many places often don't have enough staff, or there are situations you can't help it and you have to pick someone up really quickly. And it's a shame. I'm not sure how to fix that, but there is definitely a high risk of injury, I think, with any hands-on patient care, especially at the lower levels where people are often not paid well and working very long shifts. They have to do a lot of very hard work, whether that be lifting, twisting, whatever, and there's a lot of injury risk in those occupations.
If nothing else, just having a 5'2" nurse try to lift a morbidly obese patient has got to be tough.
Exactly. And it's, you know, and then you throw in someone maybe combative. They may be unconscious. There are so many factors that make even something straightforward. Let's say your patient is very small and you kind of feel like you struck gold that day because they're child-sized. And then you realize, but they're totally unconscious, and that's essentially dead weight, which is a lot more. And then, you know, there's just a lot of factors. And oftentimes when you are working on a patient in some of these occupations, you're in a small space and you don't have a lot of time or a lot of room to make the best decision for your own health.
What's the thing that you have found over the years that people understand the least about living with chronic pain?
I don't think anyone gets it until they feel it. And I don't think that's someone's fault for being that way. I think that's human nature, that we don't truly understand another person's issue, whatever that issue is, unless it hits us. I think that the best explanation I can give people when they want to understand it a little bit more is to think back to a time when you were either sick or injured and it ruined your week or your month, and you couldn't, maybe you were on crutches for 3 weeks or something, whatever it was, that it really cramped your style and ruined your life, albeit temporarily. But that's every day. Every day is that adaptation if you have chronic pain. Every day is that waking up with a sense of, what is today going to be like? How hard is today going to be? And I think that's really hard to convey to someone if they haven't gone through it.
As someone who is a teacher in the field, is that something you try to get across, maybe to be a little more empathetic when someone says they hurt?
Yes, definitely. I haven't taught for about a year now, but I did teach, I believe it was 4 years. And I still do some direct patient care too. And I really do try to check myself as well and make sure that I'm being appropriately respectful and empathetic to patients, and definitely to any students or interns or anything that I've run across. I do try to tell them suffering is real, and even though you cannot relate to it, does not mean you can't respect it.
Not naming names, and if this is uncomfortable, fine, don't answer. But in your journey through this, was there one, and you tried a lot, was there one therapy where you went, well, that was a total waste of time?
Just one. You know, probably conventional pill usage in general. I tried some things that people might consider really off the beaten path. Like, one was called iridology, where they look in your eyes. I was extremely skeptical of that, and it was actually pretty cool. But I think as far as something being totally bogus, I would say a lot of the prescriptions I was giving would fit that bill.
Hmm. What's one message you hope people come away from this book?
I hope that people remember that they still have power over their lives no matter how bad they feel. I think that patients who are suffering tend to lose their dignity and their feelings of independence, and you can get trapped going from appointment to appointment and feel like your whole life is wrapped up in this stuff. And I really think that we are truly our own best advocates. And I just hope people hear from my story after reading the book that no matter what someone tells you, it is still your life, and your day is your day, and your decision is your decision. And yeah, it may be limited by the parameters of your illness or injury, but it is still your life and not someone else's to lead.
Has this taught you anything about your relationships?
I think so, yes. I've had some really wonderful people I've come across who share their story with me or tell me they know someone who's gone through different things. And it's a different kind of bond with someone when I meet someone else who has gone through a lot of medical issues. I think we have a different type of friendship than I would have had I stayed healthy. There's that base level understanding there. And also for people who are healthy, I think for me, I went through a period of some jealousy over that, especially if they were doing things like eating fast food and I was eating impeccable health food and spending 10 times as much on it. And I think I went through that period of jealousy and realized that was really toxic for myself and for friendships, and just kind of got over it and said, that's their life, this is mine. And overall, I think this whole thing has made me more accepting of other people in general.
And you still got a wife.
I do. Yes, we just had our 11-year anniversary, and we are, happy, I think.
What didn't I ask you that people should know? That's my go-to final question.
I don't like saying never give up. I think that's truly, that is a personal choice, and giving up has a lot of definitions, but I would like to tell people to don't think that even if you have some dire news that there aren't other options out there. I know every road has an end, but I also believe that with enough investigation, there is often at least a partial solution to almost any problem.
Again, the name of Victoria Stopp's new book is Hurting Like Hell, Living with Gusto. It's published by McFarland. You can read Victoria's blog at fibromyalgiaathlete.com. We've been talking about character education over the past few weeks, and of course we mean developing a strong character in students. But there are two sides to human character, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Want to be a better person? Change your character. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Christian Miller, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, discusses why making slow incremental change is the way to get back to good.
In the ocean off Panama City Beach, two boys were drowning. To rescue them, 70 complete strangers formed a human chain stretching out into the ocean. They brought the boys to safety. Stories like this inspire us with hope about the good that human beings are capable of. But there is a darker side to our characters. Studies in psychology have found that we are willing to lie to about 30% of the people we see in a given day. Under pressure from an authority figure, many of us will even give lethal electric shocks. So where does this leave us? With the idea that our character is very much a mix of good and bad. The labels of virtue and vice just don't fit most of us very well. With our mixed characters, we aren't good enough to be virtuous, but we also are not bad enough to be vicious. Hence, there is a character gap. There is the virtuous person we should be, who stands in juxtaposition to the person we actually are. The gap between the two is often large. Fortunately, there is good news coming from psychology. Our characters are not fixed in place. We can do better, but it takes time and progress is slow. One way to do so involves moral reminders. Life often distracts us, and we lose sight of right and wrong. Moral reminders, like signing an honor code, get us back on track. A second approach has to do with role models. Abraham Lincoln and Harriet Tubman serve as great sources of wisdom and can inspire us to change our lives. A third way is through education. By learning more about character with the help of psychological research, we can resist the urge to obey a corrupt authority or remain a bystander in an emergency. The faster we can implement these approaches to bridging the character gap, the better.
That was Christian Miller of Wake Forest University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.